United States v. Fontrass, number 223119. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kathleen Donnelly and I represent Mr. Fontrass today. I will not touch upon the wiretap issues since counsel and Lewis and Pond argued that, I think, to exhaustion. As to this case, there's one undisputed fact, and that is that as of May 2020, the government knew that 3 out of the 22 defendants in this case were conspiring to kill my client, Mr. Fontrass. It is also undisputed that this Brady violation impacted the trial strategy in this case, resulting in the fact that my client sat with the co-defendant who had been trying to kill him during and before the proceedings.
But didn't you agree in your reply brief that the government provided this information to defense counsel?
Your Honor, to the extent that the court is considering documents outside the record, the answer is that as soon as I brought up this issue, and as the court is aware, the only reason that I became aware of it was that the cases were consolidated and this information was included in Mr. Lewis's PSI. So I brought that issue up because I had to actually get authorization from the court to go visit Mr. Fontrass. And what pursued was that after our opening brief was filed, for the first time, the government, in its response brief on appeal, said that it has, for reasons that are not in the record, the government has reason to dispute that defendant's factual claim that it did not disclose evidence of the threats to defendant and his counsel is not accurate. So that pursuit obviously triggered my duty to also do due diligence. I contacted the trial counsel again after having confirmed this multiple times that neither the trial counsel nor Mr. Fontrass at any time during, throughout the case, through sentencing, knew about this fact. So I checked with him and Mr. Brown kindly provided what the government thought was the basis of its belief, saying that in batch 22 of discovery, and I would remind the court, so as of May 2020, the government knows, in government's word, batch 22, which was produced less than 10 days before trial, in February of 2022, it produced some documents to trial counsel. I asked for Bates numbers. The government told me that they do not have Bates numbers for those documents. And the document that was emailed to me only had information as to Mr. Lewis, nothing as to Mr. Wells, the government's star witness. So I checked with the trial counsel again, and as you saw in the affidavit that we submitted, he confirmed that he had never clicked on the button in batch 22 because, as the court might have noticed, and I know this is a humongous record, but there was a discovery master that was appointed in this case. And the way I understand it was that everything was going through the discovery master. Nothing was going directly to trial counsel. But this particular batch that was produced with the Jinx material, or some of it, again, I have zero way of confirming this because there was no base numbers allegedly attached to these from the government. So if that is true, and if that information about Mr. Lewis, and again, I will emphasize that the government to this day has not sent me anything that includes any information about Mr. Wells. And I submitted also the proffer that was produced in this case that had zero mention of Mr. Wells' role in the attempt to kill my client. So if that is true, then we have the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel for not having pushed on that button to get that last batch of information, which would have included only information as to Mr. Lewis. So that's why the argument has been that regardless of whose fault this is, if this was, we know that for a fact as to Mr. Wells, this is the government. that to this date has not produced any information about the fact that its star witness was one of the three conspirators to kill my client, that he was the only non-government witness in this case, that he testified only against Mr. Rontres but not Mr. Lewis, something that would have been an interesting argument, aside from the fact that your star witness is trying to kill the main defendant in the case, that why he was testifying as much as Mr. Rontres but not Mr. Lewis, that why he alleged during his testimony, during the trial, that the first time that he met Mr. Lewis was during the prison time, that he didn't know him well before that. And all these other things that could have come up would have been a big part of the trial strategy in this case. The defense decision as to asking for a severance, every single decision that was made in this case, but most importantly, the fact that Mr. Rontres, again, 22 defendants. So we have Mr. Knighton.
Counsel, could we just back up to batch 22?
Yes, sir.
Are you now making an ineffective assistance of counsel argument based on what you know now?
Of course, Your Honor.
And doesn't this court generally decline to address ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal?
Unless it's a slam dunk, and unless it is something that, I mean, again,
I don't know that I've read that phrase in our cases, but I think it has a little bit more to do with the development of the record, which it sounds like they're, that hasn't really happened here. So why would we even touch this issue at this point?
Because regardless of whose fault it is, the fact remains that we have only two scenarios here, right? As to Mr. Rose, there is no discussion because unless the government stands up today and adds a new fact and tells us somehow they also included information about Mr. Wells, I'm not aware of anything that suggests that the government ever met its Brady-Giglio obligations to produce that evidence as soon as it received it. May 2022, the court's ruling, and which the government acknowledged, was very clear. If this falls under Brady, even James Act is not going to give
but
you...
But Brady only requires that you have it in time to effectively use it, right? And you had it prior to trial by, what, a couple of weeks at least?
No, Your Honor.
How far ahead?
Nothing. We never...
No, it was in the box. I mean, it was produced.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but I thought that the response was that it had been produced to you, but your counsel had not, his counsel had not reviewed those documents.
I apologize if I was not clear. So okay. We have three out of the 22 defendants, Mr. Wells, Mr. Adams, and Mr. Lewis, who were trying to kill Mr. Rontres. Mr. Wells became the government's star witness. Mr. Adams pled guilty in advance of all the other ones.
Yeah.
Mr. Lewis went to trial.
At what point do we now know that this information was available to Mr. Rontres' counsel?
At no point the information about Mr. Wells was...
Well, let's talk about Mr. Lewis then. At what point did they have the information that there was this threat by Mr. Lewis?
That they should have had it the week before the trial.
When did they have it? I'm not asking whether counsel reviewed it. When did they have it?
The week before trial, Your Honor.
So if the question is, did they have it in time to use it effectively, are you now suggesting that the Brady violation is they didn't have it in time to use it effectively?
So,
because that's what you would have to show if delay is now going to be your fallback on
it. So I'm trying to distinguish between the two. So the information about a star witness is significant and independently important to the course of the proceedings. So there's an independent Brady violation as to the information as to Mr. Wells. As to that piece, there hasn't been any justification whatsoever. We know that it happened. We know it was not produced. And we know it was prejudicial. As to the impact of it during the course of the trial, as I had tried to explain, and again, I would like to give some background about these 22 defendants and my client as the exception to the whole. If the court reviews the sentencing transcript, you see how the confusion of the court as well, the trial court, as to why is it that an over 40-year-old man who has had zero criminal record is in this situation. A man who has been looked upon and sought after from the community for help in his church, a leader, and then stuck in this situation at night. You have seen multiple conspiracies charged in this case, zero discovery of money, zero discovery of any drugs from his house, even though we had, 10,000 hours? The poll, the video was running for 14 months without any supervision. So nothing other than text messages exchanged between him and his cousin. And another interesting fact. So the person who was running this whole thing out of the state prison, Mr. Knighton, who got 300, which is, you know, he has life, right? He killed another person inside the prison. He was only moved from the state prison to federal prison. Some might call that an upgrade. And then his brother, Mr. Wells, is the second person that in a conspiracy that Mr. Montres was not a part of, was not charged with, is the only individual that the significant amount of drug was recovered from his house. And he gets one third of my client's sentence. So you have during the course of from May 2020 to the time of the trial, 20 people plead out, right? So you only have Mr. Montres and Mr. Lewis, and they go to trial together because my client had no idea that. So there was a vague allegation in the beginning to the trial counsel that there might be threats to some of these people. At no point in time there was any name named. And this is the naive guy that everybody, there were about 40 people from his church were present during sentencing, who talked about what kind of a human being he is as a father, as a churchgoer, as a leader, as someone who tries to help. And I can see after having visited him in prison that this is exactly the kind of person who would get into the familial relationship of this guy's asking me something to do. And why he didn't take a plea offer? He was offered 135 months. He was sentenced to 295, only 5 months less than the guy who ran the whole show. And if he knew, because he at no point of time, he believed that they would go after him.
Well, counsel, are you tying all of these points to your Brady claim? And
yes.
If so, could you specify the elements of the Brady claim that you are talking about?
So Brady says what? You need to know the important facts that are going to also impact your decision as to whether to take a plea or not. And of course, there's anybody, as of 2012, the Supreme Court had what the rate of 97% of our cases are being now handled, not in the criminal justice system, but in the criminal plea system. So the reality of it is that that information is absolutely critical to the whole point, every single point that he had a time to make a decision on the plea, including the days before the trial. And I have no way other than tying these two together, both as a parallel Brady violation and an outrageous Brady violation. I hope everybody can agree. And the AIC. And I see my time is up, and I would like to have the opportunity on rebuttal, so I would reserve the rest of it.
Thank you.
Good morning. James Brown from the United States. Your Honors, it's hard to respond to the arguments that have been made this morning, because almost all of them are being made based on evidence that's not in the record. And I can't just spout off evidence that's not in the record to contravene or rebut those claims, because it's just not in the record. There's just nothing, a lot of that stuff is just not in the record. When he got what, whether he opened the email, what the email said, the discovery, what was in round 22, all of it, it's not in the record. So that gets me to the claims, and I'll just go through the claims. The IAC claim, the ineffective assistance of counsel, that was raised for the first time in the reply brief, therefore it's waived. Even if it were not waived, it would be waived because it's raised for the first time on appeal, and it would be subject to plain error review. She doesn't argue plain error review, therefore the defendant has waived plain error review that claim. So the ineffective assistance claim, as Judge Matheson pointed out, is really not even up for this court's consideration, because this court normally considers those on collateral review. We think that's the proper place to consider this claim, where the district court can actually hear evidence, collect evidence, receive evidence, we get everybody on the record and find out what really happened, instead of basically speculating here at oral argument. The Jenks violation, defendant says we didn't timely give over Jenks material. Again, that's raised for the first time in a reply brief, so it's waived. And and even if it were not waived because it's raised in a reply brief, it's not briefed for plain error, so it's waived on that ground too. Under the Richardson case and Leffler case. And again,
well, as far as raising it for the first time on appeal, I mean, what counsel alleges is that she didn't know about it until she saw it in the PSR, which was included in the record on appeal. So that's the first that she knows. And then she gets your brief, and you say, well, I have reason to believe that it's, although it's not in the record, that you did receive some of this information. And so she then responds to that in her reply, which does make sense in terms of when else could she respond to whatever you provided as far as brief.
She could ask for remand of the district court for additional trial court proceedings and have this court actually grant that. But the fact is, if you don't raise an argument the record is there. And she had the record. You're obligated to raise arguments in your main response brief. That wasn't done here. It's raised in a reply. An argument raised in a reply is waived. We're just applying this court's normal rules. You know, that's just the answer to the court's question. And even so, she could have briefed it under plain error standard, and that would be the applicable standard review. It's not briefed under that standard. It's briefed as if it's not raised for the first time on appeal. And if you don't brief an argument under the plain error standard, you waive plain error review.
Well, she does raise, as to the witness, I've forgotten the name, the primary witness, she says she never did receive anything that about his threats.
Well, you know, that's you know, whether or not, that goes to the IAC issue.
I guess she's saying it goes to the Brady issue.
Right. We think it goes to the IAC issue.
She never got this information at all.
Right.
As compared to that, apparently she did receive something, or counsel received something as to Lewis.
Right. And we're not really, like I said, you know, responded to these arguments. I'm not going to talk about extra record documents or happenings or anything like that, because then, you know, there's a recording of this and it's going to be used in a 2255 proceeding. So I'm not going to argue extra record allegations with extra record responses. I just can't do that. Obviously, for reasons that the court obviously understands. You know, we really don't know what counsel knew before he went to trial. We don't know exactly what was communicated to counsel. We don't know what the defendant knew. It could be that if somebody told the defendant about the threats himself, we don't know that, if anybody told him. We don't know if the defendant would have actually taken a plea had he known about the threats. My colleague has supplied an affidavit from the defense attorney saying, oh, he would have definitely considered or reconsidered going to trial, but that affidavit does not say he would have taken a plea had he known about the threats. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that counsel did not know about the threats before trial. It just says counsel didn't open the email. I didn't open the email. I didn't open the discovery.
Is that in the record? Can we say that that's in the record?
No, I'm just care. I'm just summarizing what she says.
I understand.
I think she put the affidavit in. I think she attached it to a brief. I'm not sure.
But could we, if to the extent that the reply brief plus affidavit can be construed as a concession that information was sent to pretrial, to defense counsel, can we work with that? Is that extra record?
You know, I think it is. I think it is. The affidavit is obviously extra record. That was not received by the trial court. That was prepared by the defendant's former counsel in anticipation of argument here and for appeal.
Well, so, I'm talking
about. And it's not in the record. I don't think it's in the record.
But if the reply brief can be read as a concession, minimum, that defense trial counsel, received something from the government and failed to open the email. If that's a concession, can't you do a concession on appeal?
We would take it that way. We would take it that way. It's in black and white in the reply. I mean, that's the concession is right there in the reply. So we would certainly take it as a concession.
Right, but I'm trying to understand how that relates to your other point about not getting into material that's not in the record. But it seems to me if on appeal, parties either concede or stipulate to a fact that that's something the court can still work with. Do you agree with that?
I don't have any reason to disagree, and the court obviously knows how to handle record and extra record materials better than we do. So we would defer to the court's interpretation, but I don't see any reason to disagree with what the court has posited here at this argument.
I'm just looking for help wherever we can get.
And I wish I could be more helpful, unfortunately.
Well, and I do see that concession in the reply brief that you're discussing, and I understand that, but I'm hearing today she's making a different argument even than that, which is that, well, there was that concession that you did receive the information about Lewis, but you didn't receive it about the other.
Right, and we don't.
That's something I don't see in at least right, now in the reply brief. So.
And that's all new as far as you're concerned.
There's a lot of allegations flying around, and they're all based on extra record evidence. So I can't really stand here and say, oh, she said this then, and this then, and this then, and this then. And you know, I just can't stand here and say when I learned of what. I wish I could. There's so many things floating around. Having said that, I could address the Brady argument now. Okay.
Could you address one more time before you do that, clarify what you said when she discovered through the appellate process that there had been some discovery that may or may not have had what she needed in it about the threats? What did you suggest that she should have done to get it back to the trial court at this point?
I don't think I suggested.
I thought you were saying she had other alternatives making the argument at the appeal level.
I said she could have asked for remand. She has asked for remand. And I refer to my colleague. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. My colleague asked for remand. I think this court denied remand. Mm-hmm. So that's what my colleague could have done is ask for remand to make a record on these things. Mm-hmm. Instead of just making arguments based on extra record evidence. So, as far as even what's in Discovery Round 22, standing here, I can't tell you what's in Discovery Round 22, you know, from memory.
Right.
Getting to the Brady violation, even assuming that this stuff exists, based on the characterization that my colleague has given it, there's still not a Brady violation. Number one, to have a Brady violation, you need three things. Number one, it has to be exculpatory or favorable to the defendant, either because it's exculpatory or impeaching. Number two, it had to have been suppressed by the government. Number three, it has to be prejudicial. I'm going to start with prejudicial first let's start with suppression first. I don't know what's left of this whole suppression claim since she's agreed in the reply brief that counsel just didn't open Discovery Round 22. We don't really know if anything was suppressed. So she can't really show that anything was really suppressed. There's not any record evidence of that. Whether it was favorable or impeaching, it's not exculpatory. It was impeaching because they could have at the trial said, well, in fact, you made a threat to my client and you're biased against him. So that was impeaching. They meet that element. But then on prejudice, they can't show prejudice. They have to show that the evidence was material. And keep in mind that this was a case. Wells was not the star witness. The star witness in this case was the defendant against himself. He was the star witness. We've recounted the evidence for every single count in detail. We've given you record sites. All the evidence came from the defendant's own phone calls, on text messages, or from his house, or from drugs that he threw down as he was fleeing the police. That's what the evidence came from. Wells said, yeah, Fontras was the money man for a little while in the conspiracy and was a money collector. But that wasn't even relevant to a lot of the counts of conviction. The counts were proven up by the evidence that we put in the brief. Every single count we've gone through the evidence. They really can't show how impeaching Wells would have changed the evidentiary calculus or the probative value of the evidence. or detract from the value of that evidence, and they couldn't have. It's indisputable. It's incontrovertible because it came from the defendant himself. It's his text messages. It's his calls. It's his, it's evidence found in his own house. It's stuff he threw down when he was fleeing. Wells had nothing to do with that. He couldn't have detracted from the probative value of that evidence, even if he was impeached with this. We go through all the evidence. In fact, on counts 23 and 51, possession with intent to distribute cocaine, the 924C, the cocaine and the gun were found in his residence, had nothing to do with Trevor Wells. The claim that he would have gotten a severance, that would have changed the evidence. We still would have had all the evidence came from the defendant himself or his house. They claim that they would have accepted a plea offer. That's a conclusory assertion. There's no evidence in the record that he would have accepted a plea offer had he known about the threats. There's zero evidence. Even if you look at counsel's affidavit, which is not part of the record, that doesn't say he would have accepted a plea offer. It says he would have definitely considered it or reconsidered it or something. Doesn't say he would have accepted it. Defendants claim that he would have gotten a lower sentence had he known about this because he would have taken a plea. Nothing in the record supports that. There's nothing from the defendant. We've gone through substantial rights. Then we get to the notice prong, the fourth prong of plain error. There is no basis to notice any error in the fourth prong of plain error review. And the reason is because he was convicted based upon basically indisputable and uncontroverted evidence that came from his own text messages or statements or his own house, with which Trevor Wells had nothing to do at all. That's why the public would not be outraged if this court affirmed the conviction, because it does not impugn the judicial integrity of these proceedings. I have a minute 39 left.
How do defendants show whether they would have accepted a plea? What kind of evidence would they have to present?
Well,
other than just saying I would have considered it. I'm just curious what the proof would be.
The proof, okay. So the Supreme Court's cases say that the proof needs to, it should really be based on contemporaneous and objective evidence, that there needs to be some contemporaneous evidence that he would have and objective evidence. And that would mostly come from, he has to say, I had a conversation with my defendant or with my family, or I would have accepted a plea had I known about this, or it has to be some evidence or at least some testimony or something coming from the defendant himself. But it can't be just saying, oh, he would have accepted it without anything from the defendant himself, which is what we have here.
And it has to make sense in some fashion.
Well, that's right. It has to make sense. That's correct. It has to be objective and contemporaneous evidence, and it can't defy what the circumstances were at the time. I mean, we offered him a good deal. He didn't take it. It wasn't a good enough deal, and then he went to trial and lost. And of course, now he's going to say, "Oh, I would have taken a plea if I'd known about this." So the court has to look at it through that lens as well. I mean, there's obviously a colorable bias to take a plea now since you've been convicted and got a lot more time. I will not address the authorization argument. My time is up anyway. We've already talked about that. I have nothing further to add unless the panel has questions. We'd ask for an affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We have some rebuttal time.
It's disheartening that I have not heard a word about how horrible this is, that you're standing here today talking about the fact that the government did not disclose that its main witness in this case was trying to kill the defendant. It is also disheartening that the affidavit that I submitted specifically says, I believe that if such information were known before the trial, Mr. Ventress would have reconsidered his decision to reject the plea offer provided by the government.
What about the materiality point, that the evidence really came from himself and nothing would have changed?
Which evidence?
The materiality argument.
The materiality of the fact that there were three people out of the co-defendants who were trying to kill my client?
No, the Mr. Brown's argument that what really convicted the defendant was the text, the evidence found, that sort of thing.
Well, the issue of, so I will remind the court that the theme of the trial was loyalty, not money, because there was zero money, zero drugs, And then this guy was not a material witness. We offered him 110 months. The only person that they recovered 9 pounds of drugs from. And he was yet not a material witness. That is the only reason that he was offered that offer. And today now that is not material. And I see my time is up, but I would really beg the court to allow me to finish this, because this is important that this is now the misstatement of the affidavit that I submitted from the trial counsel. I have talked to Mr. Wontrust. I submit to the court that I speak for Mr. Wontrust, who would have accepted that plea offer had he known that two of his cousins were trying to kill him. That now his three children are out there and probably going to end up in the system because he's not there. And again, I cannot emphasize the fact as to, did I not raise in the opening brief the issue of Jenks, the Brady, that the Brady material should have been timely? I mean, how many of these are enough? And the information that came from Mr. Brown to me as to batch 22, as to what was in it and what was not in it. I have asked multiple times. The only thing that came was about Mr. Lewis, nothing about Mr. Wells. And at some point, this should be enough. And I asked for a remand that the court denied. There should be ways to put these things on the record that if by chance this information was not disclosed in the consolidated record, we would never know about this. And I sure hope that in the United States of America, this does not happen over and over again from now on, that there should be an opinion addressing this. And that is our request to the court. Thank you so much, Bruno.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have any other questions? Okay. That will conclude this morning's argument in this case and all of this morning's arguments, although I guess we're in this afternoon at this point. Thank you both, counsel, for your presentations. The case will be submitted. Counsel are excused, and the court will stand in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.